Oh, worse, replied Snowl. Good, good, said Arsabagger. We must keep this to a totally factual interview, you understand. How would he steals babies and drinks their blood do? Fine, fine, said Snowl. Exactly. I think you mentioned, said Arsabagger, when you filed dispatches, that you had several times met this... what is his name? This defiler of established governments? Tyler? Yes, that you met him in personal combat. Other commanders were hearing this, and Rogo Dieter had not thought it would become public property. He had reckoned without the publicity hunger of his uncle. Not exactly, said Rogo Dieter quickly. I meant to say that I tried, but he always ran away. Quarter Admiral Snowleader's voice came from the background behind Arsabagger. But he won't get away again. Now, in your opinion, Rogo Dieter, do you truly think this is the one? The small gray man had been watching all this on his view screens. He detested reporters, and this Roof Arsabagger had earned his particular dislike. The reporter's fangs were stained nearly black, there were blotches of some disease on his face, and one could almost smell his unwashed condition over the view screen. Unfortunately or fortunately, whichever way you looked at it, his couriership had come in just yesterday. It had brought lots of odds and ends, but among them was the clear-cut statement that the one had not been found. Along with that, there was a prize edition. The 100 million credits originally offered by the Hauven Interrelated Confederation of Systems had been doubled by the Bulbod Equality Empire. The small gray man did not know what was going on in other sectors, much less other universes, but he could suppose that the same mad scramble was in progress. The courier dispatch box contents, when viewed as a whole, said that these were indeed very strange and troublesome times, that a problem like this had not existed in any past history they were aware of. And there had been some hints about the vital necessity of his presence, where he could do some good, instead of out here sailing around a 12th-rate Rimstar's only planet. There was no direct criticism, of course. There were just hints, an undertone. But actually, it would not matter whether he were home or not. Unless some solution presented itself, the chaos that was going to ensue would be so vast that neither he nor others could hope to control it. He was going on listening absently to this asinine reporter interview an asinine military mind when his bridge buzzer sounded and his watch officer's face appeared on the screen. "Your Excellency," said the watch officer, "there is something going on down in that capital city area. The infra beams are scrambling. We cannot tell what is happening. There are no clear pictures." The interview cut off suddenly. Other commanders seemed to have noticed it. The Hockner commander appeared on the small gray man's screen.
"Your Excellency, I believe you said that was the central seat of government. We are getting pictures of massed troops and recordings of excessive heat. In your opinion, is this political?"
The small gray man looked at his own screens of the area. Bad as they had been before due to a local storm, they were incredibly bad now. One couldn't make out a thing. Some sort of interference was blasting them off the air. Wait, that jagged traveling line on the screen. A teleportation trace. Hastily, the small gray man thought of an answer. "I believe," he said conservatively to the Hockner, "that it is probably political in some connected way. All the information that..." His screens almost caved in. There was a tremendous flare, then nothing. A squawk horn was going. "Screen overload! Screen overload!" Good heavens, you never got that except in a major battle area. The small gray man rushed to his port as he knew the commanders must be doing. He stared down. There was a babble of incredulity on the remaining voice channels from the other ships. The storm there had almost been exploded away. A fireball was climbing heavenward. Spreading, rolling masses of coiling smoke and flame were rising to incredible heights. Daylight was dimmed by the flash. It looked like the world had been torn apart. 6. Sir Robert hardly waited for the earth to cease rumbling. He did not even ask himself what it could be. He had only one idea in mind, to get his hands loose and help Johnny. He had seen the arrow strike Johnny. He had seen the lad pull it out. Sir Robert knew it was a poisoned arrow, and he had some idea of the consequences. After such venom entered, physical exertion would spread it all through the body much more quickly, and Johnny had been moving violently. When the hatchet had cut the cord, it had not gone all the way through. Sir Robert strained every sinew to part the remaining strands. It was dark as pitch in this dome. He could not even see where Johnny had fallen or which way he lay, but these confines were very close. He could and must get to him, even though it was probably already too late. He almost tore the skin off his wrists. The cord parted. In feverish haste, he reached out, felt around, and found Johnny's arm, the wounded arm. Sir Robert closed his huge hand around it, just below the armpit, and held it tight, shutting off the blood flow. The hatchet had fallen here somewhere. The rocking must have sent it skidding. Moaning with urgency, Sir Robert felt around the metal floor, under the console, under Johnny. Suddenly, his fingers contacted its handle in a corner. He got hold of the head, just back of the blade. He tried to cut through Johnny's radiation suit sleeve. It was so hard to work with just one hand, and in the dark. He was also trying desperately not to cut into Johnny's flesh. He got a fold of the suit and sawed through it. The hatchet had been dulled and chipped while cutting the cables. The leaded sleeve material was very resistant. He was not making it, not with one hand. Suddenly, he remembered that Johnny always had thongs in his pouch. It lay under his body, but he got it loose. He reached in and found broken glass that sliced his fingers. He paid it no attention. He found the end of a long thong and drew it out. He put a piece of twisted mine lamp metal under the arm and against the artery, and wrapped it around and in place with the thong. He drew the thong as tightly as he could and tied it. Now he could work. He cut the radiation suit sleeve away just below the tourniquet. He stripped it off the arm. The cloth was matted with blood. The arm was slippery with it. It was hard to find the wound because of the blood. He found it. He took the edge of the hatchet blade and cut an X across the wound hole. He got out of his air mask and put his mouth to the wound. Anything to get all the poison out that he could. Time and time again he sucked the wound dry and spat. The taste of the blood was stinging and bitter. There was venom in it, all right. Finally, he thought the blood was cleaner. He did not know how deep the arrow had gone, but there was no way to probe. He worked the flesh of the arm in a way he thought would force more poison up to the surface of the wound. He again applied his mouth to it. Yes, there was more bitterness. Then it seemed cleaner. Sir Robert felt around Johnny's belt for a wound compress pack. He didn't find one. Well, the bleeding was slightly less now. Maybe no vein had been hit. It was probably better without a compress. He felt the pulse of Johnny's other wrist. Devils in hell, it was racing. The pulse was way above anything he could count. Johnny's body was stretched taut. There was a tremble in the limbs. Sir Robert, in the dark, tried to find the ampule in Johnny's pouch. Planning dictated there should be one. That broken glass might have come from the mine lamp. He found the bottom half of the ampule. Although he couldn't see what he was doing, and it was just a gesture more than anything else, he opened the wound and upended the broken bottle over it, close to it, pouring in anything that might be in it. He held and massaged the flesh in such a way as to let any liquid drop lower in the wound. It was probably just his imagination, he thought, but the arm area felt slippery. He felt the pulse. It was racing faster, if anything, and the limbs were trembling more. Had he done all he could? He couldn't think of anything more. The air was getting used up in this close space, and he put his air mask back on. Johnny's radiation mask was in the way, and he took it off and checked the air mask under it. The flutter valve was moving slightly, but very rapidly. In briefing, They were supposed to put in a new bottle just before the first alert. If Johnny had done that, he had 2 hours of air. Sir Robert sank back. He worked the bonds off his ankles and then straightened Johnny's body out and raised Johnny's head to his own knee to keep the head higher. Double devils in hell, but the limbs trembled. He thought the situation over. He had not been in on the last briefings. He did not know whether there had been anything he should know now. Bitterly, Sir Robert cursed his own stupidity. Since things had been going so smoothly with the Academy move, one night he had walked by himself, like a daft sheep, to a knoll to look at the compound. Not really any purpose in it. Just a review of the field where a battle would soon be fought. And Brigantes had grabbed him. They must have been watching him for days. They had trussed him up and kept him in a cavern. They had tried to interrogate him and had beaten him. His nose was broken and full of dried blood even now. But he was too old a campaigner to talk. He did not know what they wanted with him until they brought him into the compound area and dumped him. He had not really thought they would take him to Cyclo until they put the air mask on him. The thought had made even him sweat. He had an excellent example of how the Cyclos interrogated. Allison. Sir Robert had been braced to stand up to it. He had known of this attack, but he could not see how he could be fished out. A flamethrower was supposed to sweep that platform clean. And then this lad had thrown his flamethrower down and attacked. It looked like such a hopeless effort. Because of Sir Robert, this lad had thrown away his own chances. His own life? Sir Robert felt the pulse again. Good God, how long could a pulse race like that without a person dying? He began to get uneasy about the silence outside. There was supposed to be a standby rescue crew deep in the old compound, waiting with flatbeds and planes, with both Dr. Allen and Dr. McKendrick, all in radiation suits and air masks. It was so silent in here. Was that a slight crackling sound? Johnny would have had a mine radio. Sir Robert felt around Johnny's belt and then scrabbled around the floor. He had it. A crackling sound was coming out of it. It was live, but no voices. Were they all dead out there? He pressed the transmit button. Hello? Hello? Not clever to say more. Who knew who might be out there? Silence. Hello? Hello? Then he thought he'd better give them a location. Not clever, but he had to do it. Console talking. Was that the click of a transmit switch? Then a voice in a whisper as though from far away. Is that you, Sir Robert? It was Thor's voice. Sir Robert almost wept with relief. Thor? Yes, Sir Robert. Thor, Johnny is in here. He has had a poisoned arrow in him. You've got to get him out quick. Then Dr. Allen.
Sir, do you have a radiation suit on?
No, blast ye. I've no suit. To heel with that. Get the lad out.
Sir, is his suit whole?
Sir Robert realized he had torn the sleeve off.
No.
I'm sorry, sir,
whispered Dr. Allen over the mine radio.
To open that dome would kill you both. Have a little patience. We're trying to find out what we can do.
Patience be domned, stormed Sir Robert.
His extreme urgency was throwing his speech into dialect.
Get the lad out.
There was no answer. Sir Robert was about to start banging on the inside of the dome. Didn't they realize Johnny was probably dying in here? Then a tiny, piping, whispering voice took over.
Sir Robert?
It was one of the young Buddhist communicators, probably the youngest they had. They had turned him over to a child. The war chief was about to thunder a damnation at them when the child whispered, speaking Cyclo,
Sir Robert, they are doing all they can, honored sir. It is pretty bad out here.
Where are you?
Demanded Sir Robert, reverting to Cyclo.
I am just outside the dome, honored sir. My mind radio is inside my air mask, under my radiation face shield. Excuse me that I whisper. We want nothing picked up by the visitors above. They can't hear this, and the mind radio won't reach them.
What are the visitors doing?
I don't know, Sir Robert. The snow clouds have closed in again. I see a pilot communicator. I will ask. I will be right back.
There was a long pause. Then the tiny, shrill little voice.
Sir, the pilot communicator says they have moved in orbit and are somewhere above us. They have this place being looked at. But our battle planes are standing by. Dunnel Dean is up there. He wants to know how we are. How is Lord Johnny?
Sir Robert felt the shaking limbs of the body resting against him, but he knew morale was a factor up there in the sky. He could not tell them he thought Johnny was dying, but Johnny was still alive. Tell them they should not worry just now. The child was gone for a bit. Then the tiny whispering voice.
The pilot communicator passed it on.
What are they doing here to get us out? Demanded Sir Robert. What hell it was, sitting here in the dark, waiting. Johnny's breathing was too rapid by far.
It's very bad out here, Sir Robert, very bad. If you hear crackling, it's the power lines. They are all shorted out and burning on the ground, throwing sparks.
Are there any casualties in the raiding party?
Oh, we don't know that, Sir Robert. The rescue team is using blade scrapers to uncover the coffins. I'm standing beside a hole where the platform used to be. It's smoking. Is it hot in there?
Sir Robert had not noticed. Then he realized that the dome was warm to the touch. He said so.
I'm told to tell you not to release the annealing lever on the dome skids. It is a wonder that they held. So don't release the lever. They will move the whole metal platform.
Somebody else was coming through on the channel. Dwight! Can you hear us? Dwight! The tiny voice of the child said,
They found his coffin under the ravine bank just now. The bank caved in on it. They have found a forklift in the garage that operates, and they are lifting the coffin. They are opening the lid. Dwight looks stunned, but he is sitting up.
They should be working on this dome, raged Sir Robert.
Oh, there's a whole other team working on it, honored sir. They are bringing a small crane out of the lower levels of the compound now. I see a man throwing clamps on the big crane. It is on its side, and they have to lift it upright.
Sir Robert was getting an idea of what it was like out there.
We were down in the 16th level, said the tiny voice. The concussion was bad. It grabbed air out of the place, but nothing was heard.
Well, what was it? What happened? Demanded Sir Robert.
We don't know, honored sir.
They had some nuclear weapons on standby. Did they explode? There was a pause. The child had gone off somewhere. He came back.
No, sir. Thor says they are intact and he is awfully relieved. They didn't explode.
Then what was it?
I am so very sorry, sir. None of us knows. Oh, here comes a blade scraper to loosen your platform so it can be lifted. The first one they had broke down after they got the fire out of it. I am told you must be patient, sir. We are doing all we can.
Then,
they've got three more coffins out now.
A pause. Then, sorrow.
The one they call Andrew is dead.
The platform gave a jolt as the blade scraper seemed to pry under it. Sir Robert could hear a motor roar. There was a shout of alarm and then a crash. Then the piping little voice,
One of the poles fell in the crater. No one was hurt. Here comes your flatbed truck, sir.
Flatbed? Barked Sir Robert. It's supposed to be a plane. We're supposed to airlift out of here. There was a pause. The Buddhist communicator had gone off somewhere. He came back.
They have found a river to the south. It is the Purgatoire. The pilots told us.
Sir Robert felt Johnny's pulse, racing. I don't understand, cried Sir Robert. Time is everything here. I need serum. Can't we lift this dome and push some serum in here?
I am sorry, Sir Robert. The Purgatoire is 120 miles south of here. It's on an ancient man highway.
He rushed on so Sir Robert wouldn't interrupt.
They have mine pumps out. All our equipment and planes are contaminated. They have to be hosed down to get rid of radiation. When that's done, they can open the dome.
Sir Robert clenched his fists. 120 miles. How long would that take? The child must have been reading his thoughts.
I am told they will drive very fast. They can on the ancient highway. Thor himself will drive your flatbed. They know how important it is. Your flatbed will be the first to leave. They have your crane standing up now.
There was another chunk from the blade scraper. Something under the platform seemed to tear loose.
They have found 15 coffins now, said the child. The Scots in them were all alive except one. The coffin was blown into the air and smashed his skull. The lead on the outside of the coffins is all melted. The tops, I mean. They're hot to the touch, and it's hard to handle them.
There was a groan and a squeak as the crane hook on top of the dome tightened. They were being very careful from the sound of it not to drop the lower platform off. The annealing skids held. Sir Robert felt them swinging in the air, then a thump as they hit the top of the flatbed body. They picked it up again to let it drop down more squarely. The child must still be standing on the platform overhanging. The tiny voice calmly came through.
I can see better from here. It's not snowing. Way out on the plain over there, I see some bodies. Must be the Brigante tribe. And I can see more coffins.
He yelled to someone and must be pointing.
The whole top of the old compound had blown off. It's wide open to the winds.
Sir Robert was feeling Johnny's pulse. Was it weaker?
Thor is turning over to someone. He is climbing in your truck now. He says he's a good driver. Don't worry. He will go as fast as he can. Excuse me, but I am supposed to get in the cab and tie a seatbelt.
The flatbed started up with a roar. It jolted and banged over the uneven terrain. Sir Robert steadied Johnny's head. Was he still breathing? They hit the ancient man highway. The engine revved into a high-pitched scream. Sir Robert remembered Johnny had had a watch. He tried to find its illumination button. The numbers were rolling. They were driving so fast, Sir Robert could hear the wind roaring outside the dome. Time, time, time. 50 minutes. 52 minutes. 59 minutes. The flatbed abruptly slowed. It jolted down some rough ground. It halted with a surge. It dropped to the earth. The small piping voice again.
We are at the river bank. There is plenty of water. They are rigging a mine pipe. I must get away from the dome while it is washed down. I have to get washed down myself, and so do the others. Then they will test with breathe gas.
Water was suddenly pounding against the dome. It roared and reverberated inside. The sound went all around. And then the water went all over the flatbed, apparently. There was silence then. Then the piping voice.
Sir Robert, the truck with the small crane has arrived and has been washed down. So have I. Can you find the release lever in there? The one outside is bent.
Sir Robert had already located and indeed had been on the verge of pulling it an hour ago. He yanked it open. There was a roar and a clank as a crane was moved closer and connected. The dome lifted. Murky daylight hit his eyes. Johnny was lying there. Was he breathing? The owner of the small voice was standing there, dripping water, visor and air mask off. He was about 13.
My name is Kwong. Thank you for being so patient with me, Sir Robert. I was as worried as you.
Dr. Allen jumped up on the flatbed. He had a syringe in his hand and was grabbing Johnny's arm. A woman nurse took over. She was holding Johnny's head. Sir Robert stood up unsteadily. He was drenched with sweat, and the wind was cold. He looked to the north. The sky was glowing there. "What's that?" he demanded. Thor was there, another member of the rescue team. More trucks were arriving further downstream. Thor said, "That's Denver." Sir Robert stared. They had just come from hell. Chapter 25. 1. For the first time in what had been a dreary, wearisome year, the small gray man was intense and interested. Hope, to which he had become a stranger, struggled to rise in his breast. Faint still, but it was there. He had no real interest in the overpowering flash they had seen, and almost did not bother to watch the roiling, filthy mass of violent cloud which rose above the earth. It was that momentary trace on his screen, a teleportation firing, a trace he had never hoped to see again. His immediate reaction was to see whether any of these military minds in the ships around had seen the flickering trace. He listened anxiously to their chatter.
"It was obviously a nuclear explosion," said the Bulbod.
That settled it for him. He thrust his pugnacious face forward from his collar until it was almost visible, as though daring somebody to dispute him. The Tallnep half-captain made an immediate proposal to go down there and
really wipe the place out.
The Hauven speculated that the situation might be political and sought to pull the small gray man into it. But the small gray man was noncommittal. He was waiting to see what the others knew. It was the Hockner super-lieutenant who summed it up. He put his monocle to his eye and sniffed at them.
"You fellows are missing the point, rather," he said. "Earlier intelligence told of a night raiding party vanishing in the area. Quite obviously, what we have just seen is the culmination of a political surface war. And I rather say that the government has now changed hands. As we know, the political scene was unstable. A priesthood earlier took over the planet, those yellow fellows in the robes. But they lost out, perhaps, and were driven back to that temple in their southern hemisphere. Some military group," he concluded, "has now obliterated the former capital of the planet with nuclear weapons. With two separate revolts in just the last few months, the political climate is highly unstable, and the time is ripe for a concerted attack by us."
"Yes," rumbled the Bulbod. "We should go right down and smear them."
The Jambit Chow commander laughed lightly.
"I am afraid you will have to count me out, gentle sirs. For the moment, at least. Have you looked over there at that shoulder on the mountain peak? The one just to the west of the capital?"
There was silence, and then some startled gasps. 15 assorted battle planes and marine attack carriers were just now rising into view.
"It was an ambush," said the half-captain.
"Bah," said the Bulbod. "Their firepower does not compare to even one of our major vessels."
"They could be quite nasty," said the Jambit Chow in his lilting voice.
There was a lull. Abruptly, a face filled the viewer of the small gray man. It was Roof Arsabagger of the Midnight Fang, calling from the Tallnep Terrify-class battle plane launching capital ship Capture.
"Your Excellency," drooled the reporter, "could we take advantage of this lull to get your personal reactions to this general situation?"
The small gray man was always calm, never emotional. All he said, and in a quiet voice, was,
"Get out of my view screen." "Oh, yes, sir, Your Excellency. Indeed, sir, Your Excellency. At once, sir."
The diseased face vanished. The small gray man made a grimace of distaste and then went back to considering the rest of them. Sooner or later, they would come to some conclusion and take some concerted action. So far, none had mentioned the teleportation trace. None of them was coming to any logical conclusion. Was each one privately hungering for prize money and keeping the rest in the dark? He would listen. It was always safe to listen. The combined force had come alive and was changing position in orbit so as to maintain its location above this area. Flashes of engine exhausts were apparent in the sky around, and a mutter of internal ship commands trickled through the channels. They were readying themselves. It was the Hauven who finally expressed something that might have been on all their minds, the rewards.
"I have just worked out that they might be the one and don't know. There is a report here of a big cyclo walking around a firing platform down there earlier this day."
"Well, if it was a cyclo, don't you think he would have known?" said the Jambit Chow commander.
This brought the Hockner super-lieutenant into it.
If the silly fool didn't know, he still might have been the one.
But if he had been the one, said the Hoffin, he would know. And he didn't know, so this isn't the one.
The Quarter Admiral chipped in, tapping a tooth thoughtfully.
As the possibility now exists that they are the one.
Other faces looked at him on their view screens, unable to figure out how he had gotten to this conclusion.
Why, then I see no reason to hold off further from simply raiding the place and gutting it and then clearing out. But, on the other hand,
continued the Quarter Admiral in a brilliant spurt of logic,
if they are the one, then they constitute an extreme danger to us and should be raided. Either way, we simply raid it, divide up the loot, and clear out.
And the reward money?
Said the Jamba Chow.
Why, said the Quarter Admiral, we can best find out about that with an extensive interrogation of the resulting prisoners. As commander-in-chief of this combined force.
There were instant protests. They agreed that in any event they should attack, gut the place, and clear out. But they didn't agree that the Quarter Admiral was their commander-in-chief. This produced a very sour effect on Quarter Admiral Snowleader. Rufe Arsabogger being aboard, he wanted to get the best possible image. This disagreement didn't fit with it, and it made him quite cross. The ensuing wrangling took considerable time, and the small gray man returned to studying the scene below. He had spotted a small convoy racing south. It was in two sections. The first, smaller section, was streaking down what must have been an ancient highway. The second was larger and driving nearly as fast. At first, it might appear that the second was chasing the first. But now they had come together without a fight on the banks of a river. They must all be the same group. The stream was in spring flood, and shortly after the arrival of the first section, water pumps were placed and huge sprays of water were visible. They were spraying down their vehicles and themselves. The action was not known to the small gray man, so he consulted some reference books. Radiation. The way to get rid of contamination was copious use of water. The particles could be washed down and away due to their weight. Then that had been a nuclear blast. The cyclos down through the ages had remorselessly suppressed anyone seeking to use such weapons. It was a nearly forgotten chapter of ancient warfare. The small gray man had his communication officer tune in his view screens better. There was haze and overcast down there, a little difficult to see through. The city to the north had begun to burn quite fiercely, a glow under the clouds of spiring smoke. The wind was from the south, and even though this left the river area where the trucks had arrived clearer, there was a lot of interference. Ah, it was that shorting power line to the old mine site. It made the view screen jump and distort. It took some time for the group at the river to sort itself out. What were they? Refugees? The remains of an attack force? And then he saw it. Under that dome they had raised, with a crane, a teleportation console. He began to piece this situation together. He did not know why or how, but that fight and explosion had to do with teleportation. One or another of these commanders in the ships about him would invite his advice. He would answer noncommittally. For once, he would not be helpful at all. He hoped and prayed they would not see that console down there. The group apparently had some wounded and were caring for them, and their attention for quite a span was not on security. The console was sitting there, plain as day. Finally, six Marine attack battle planes flew in and landed. There was heavy air cover over this group, quite in addition to the landed planes. The small gray man kept his eye on that console. They finally shrouded it and moved it into one of the Marine attack planes. The Hockner super-lieutenant suddenly said,
"Wasn't that a transshipment console they transferred from truck to plane? I'm playing back my screens."
The small gray man sagged. He had not wanted them to see that. He had hoped they wouldn't recognize one if they did see it. Vain hope.
"It is," said the Hockner.
It took them quite a while to load down there. Some of the marine attack planes were quite empty. Two were very fully loaded. The small gray man looked up capacities. Yes, two marine attack planes could handle that entire party. The commanders were now chattering at a great rate. Some had seen pictures of such consoles. There was a rising tide of excitement, a rising vision of sharing in 200 million credits of reward money. Then the group down there abandoned the flatbeds and pumps and a crane and what might be a couple of coffins. Six marine attack planes took off. And then they did a very puzzling and confusing thing. Instead of assuming an orderly formation, they began to crisscross each other's bows and circle and dart. It was quite impossible, even on a screen playback, to tell which marine attack carrier was which. Four of them landed again. Which four? Which were the loaded ones? The commanders really chattered over this. They were playing back screens, looking for identifying marks. Not possible in this static. Abruptly, the Hochner solved it. Two of the planes, with only a small part of the additional air cover, took off at a leisurely pace, only 1,000 miles an hour, on a northeasterly course. The other four and the remaining, but majority air cover planes, stayed at the river.
"It's a lure," cried the super-lieutenant. "They want us to follow that northeast group."
They watched, plotting the course of the northeast group. It would pass over this side of the pole and, unless it stopped before that, would wind up at that pagoda place in the southern hemisphere, and at that speed would get there in about 9 hours. As if to confirm the Hochner's suspicions, the remaining four marine attack planes and the rest of the air cover suddenly streaked away on a course slightly to the west of north. They were traveling at 2,000 miles an hour. A hasty extrapolation of their course gave their only possible destination as an ancient mine site near a place which had been called Singapore.
"That does it, old fellow," said the Hochner. "There is a report here that there's been heavy activity in that area and some sort of platform being laid out. They're taking that console to Singapore."
The quarter admiral tried to disagree. As the senior officer, he had a right to be obeyed. He explained that it must be the pagoda. The reason was that he hated all religions. Religious people were zealots and upset governments and always had to be crushed. This obviously was a religious revolt, and they even had evidence of it. A religious order had upset the government of the planet and had now stolen a console. This planet was the one, and he ordered them all to head for the pagoda objective. His order did it. The combined force streaked into controlled motion, in full cry, after the Singapore-bound group. But the mighty Terrify-class battle plane launching capital ship Capture did not follow them. Egged on by Ruf Arsebager into independent action that would make better copy, and by a scathing hatred of all religions, Quarter Admiral Snowleader turned his ponderous and overwhelming ship, with its belly full of battle planes, toward Kariba. 2. Johnny woke with a start of alarm. The ground had shaken. A woman nurse who must have been at his bedside left the room. He stared around him, for a moment unable to place the unfamiliar surroundings. Then he recognized them. It was the bunker room at Kariba that the Chinese had fixed up especially for him, at the inner edge of the hollow of the firing platform. They had ringed the inside hill with deep bunkers and even tiled some of them. They were lit with mine lights. This one was tiled in yellow. It was furnished with a bed, chairs, and a wardrobe. They had even done a portrait of Chrissy in the tiles, taking it from a picto-recorder shot. It looked quite like her, except that they had slightly slanted her eyes. The ground jolted again. Bombs? He was just about to swing out of bed when Dr. Allen came in and soothingly pushed him back.
"It's all right," said Dr. Allen. "They have things under control out there."
He was taking Johnny's pulse. Sir Robert showed up in the doorway. He had a bandage across his nose, which Dr. Allen had set. He was obviously waiting for Dr. Allen to finish.
"You had a nasty one," said Dr. Allen, "but your pulse is normal now. That prevention shot of serum you had handled some of the venom reaction. But you really owe it all to Sir Robert. He got the poison out, and even gave you a few drops of serum.
Johnny's huge cyclo wristwatch was lying on the side table. He stared at it. He had been asleep for 18 hours. Lord knows what had happened in that time.
Dr. Allen anticipated him. I know. But it was necessary to put you on an opiate to slow your heart down.
He had a stethoscope on Johnny's chest. He listened. Then he folded it up.
I can't detect any heart damage. Hold out your hand.
Johnny did.
Ah, no tremble, said Dr. Allen. I think you're fine. A few days in bed.
At that moment, the ground jolted again. Johnny tried to get up, and Dr. Allen pushed him back again.
Sir Robert, called Johnny. What's happening?
Dr. Allen nodded to Sir Robert that it was all right, and then left. Sir Robert came over to stand beside the bed. He was not answering Johnny's questions. He just stood there, beaming down at Johnny, glad to see him alive. The lad even had color in his cheeks.
What is happening? Said Johnny, spacing each word.
Oh, said Sir Robert. That's a Tolnep ship up there. It's at about 200 miles, but it keeps sending down planes to bomb this place. We have air cover. Stormalong is here and directing air defenses. So far, the enemy is giving Singapore its main attention.
Angus was at the door. Johnny called to him,
Have you set up the console?
Oh, aye, said Angus.
He came in.
That's why they didn't disturb you.
He pointed a finger up.
With all that firing, our anti-aircraft outside the screen, and the motors of our own planes, we wouldn't dare use the firing rig. It's all connected. The Chinese set that place up very nice.
The next firing position of the switch is down, said Johnny.
Yes, Sir Robert told us that. It's all ready to go if this firing ever stops. Get a rest.
Angus left and passed Thor. Thor said, How do you feel? Johnny waved his hand negatively. Unimportant. The last I remember was being in the dome. You better bring me up to date. They told him what had happened and what they had done.
A recoil that bad? Said Johnny.
Worse, said Thor.
How many men did we lose? Said Johnny.
Andrew and MacDougall, said Thor.
But we have 15 of them here in this little hospital they have. Couple of concussions, broken arms or legs. Mostly bruised, very badly bruised. The lead of the coffins protected them. No radiation burns. Andrew was badly bayoneted by the Brigantes and couldn't fasten his coffin lid from inside, and it blew open.
And MacDougall, said Johnny.
Well, that one is sort of bad. He had the station over by the old cage, and the coffin was jolted out of the ground. We couldn't find his body for a while, and that's what got us looking.
Johnny noticed Thor was holding a heavy package. He had steadied it against the table.
We had to start looking for corpses. They had been blown all around, most of the flesh burned off.
We followed the blast line, thinking his body had been blown directly away from the platform. And we got into what was left of Turtle's office. The whole top of it had been blown off. 4 or 5 bodies from the platform edge had been blown into that area. We didn't want to leave anyone listed simply as missing, so we were trying to identify bodies. We found MacDougall's body.
And we found this.
He was unwrapping the heavy package.
I know you will be relieved to have it. One of the corpses had all the flesh burned off, and the vertebrae were exposed, and this was sticking in them.
It was a pea-sized pellet of the unknown core material of the bomb.
Brown limper, said Johnny.
Turl threw it at him, like a bullet. Yes, I am very, very glad you found it.
We got the other package Turtle handed to him, said Thor. We gave it to Angus, and he disarmed it.
What does it do?
We don't really know, said Johnny. But knowing Turl,
we got his whole recycling basket, said Thor. We figured he'd try to use it, and we cut the power off. It's really full.
It's out here on a dolly if you want it. We had it in a radiation-proof mine sack, fortunately.
He beckoned toward the door.
We grabbed it right after he left his office.
A ghillie wheeled the dolly in. They had stacked the material neatly on it.
Don't try to fire those assassin pistols, said Thor. Care put a plug in them so they'd shoot out the back at the user? Care said to tell you, and that he'd fix them back.
They handed Johnny some of the booklets and papers that had been in the false backs and bottoms of the cabinets. Johnny had a lot of it already. His eye was caught by a pamphlet, Known Defenses of Hostile Races and Surveys of Their Homelands. He thumbed through it.
A lot of planets here.
He looked under Tolmep. This planet is a planet of a double star system. See coordinate chart for location. The system itself has only three inhabited planets, the 7th, 8th, and 9th. The Tolnep homeland is the 9th planet. It has 5 moons. Of these, only Asart is important. It is used as the launch of major war vessels. No Tolnep vessel can operate in atmosphere due to the great inefficiency of its star energy drives, which, being essentially reaction engines, use up too much of their power in atmospheres. After construction, such vessels are based on the moon, Asart, and their crews and material are ferried to them from planet surface. Since plans have been proposed from time to time to occupy and mine the Tolnep planet, and since usual offensive tactics are thought to be adequate in the event of such a war, the moon Asart has not been assaulted up to the time of this writing. Johnny looked at the cyclo date. It was only a couple of years old. The catalog went on. Johnny laid it down. Another thud and ground shake. Suddenly, Johnny was aware of the underlying tension in all those who had come in. They were just trying to make him feel easy. Thor had received an urgent summons while he had been reading. And now a communicator rushed in with a sheaf of dispatches for Sir Robert and rushed out. Johnny saw the frown flicker across Sir Robert's face as he read them.
The situation is worse than you're letting on, isn't it? Said Johnny.
Nah, said Sir Robert. Dinna fret yoursel', laddie.
What is the situation? Demanded Johnny. Sir Robert never dropped into dialect unless agitated. The grizzled old Scot sighed and recovered his university accent.
Well, if you must have it, we have lost the initiative. For whatever reason, the enemy has decided to attack in force.
He tapped the reports.
Singapore is holding so far, and right now has tied down about 3/4 of their forces. But they won't be tied down there forever. The Russian base is getting the attention of planes from a large war vessel. Edinburgh is getting hit. Neither of the last two places have any armor cable coverage. And up there, he pointed, is a huge monster of a battleship that has been sending planes and bombs down for several hours. It could also launch up to 1,000 Tolnep Marines, and we aren't that well equipped to handle an assault force by land. So, there you have it. It can only get worse, not better.
Call Dr. Allen, said Johnny. I'm getting up.
Sir Robert tried to protest, but he finally called the doctor in. Dr. Allen did not like it.
You're full of a drug we found called sulfur that will prevent infection and blood poisoning. You'll feel dizzy if you get up suddenly. I don't advise it.
Nevertheless, Johnny insisted. He knew they were doing all they could, but he wanted to look over the situation. He just couldn't sit still and be pounded to bits. Johnny couldn't see any clothes. A coordinator showed up with an elderly, gray-headed Chinese man.
This is Mr. Tsung, said the coordinator. He has been in charge of fixing up your room. He has been learning a little English, so he can help you.
Mr. Tsung bowed. He was obviously pleased to see Johnny, but the thudding bombs also held some of his attention. He had a bowl of soup for Johnny to drink, and his hand shook a bit as he held it out. Johnny would have laid it down, but Mr. Tsung shook his head.
Drink, drink, said Mr. Tsung. Maybe so, no chance eat later.
Another communicator beckoned to Sir Robert from the door, and the old Scot rushed out.
Mr. Tsung was getting his nervousness under control. The novelty of meeting Johnny was wearing off, and now that he was doing something, the sporadic thuds of bombs seemed less. And then a conviction came to him that if anybody could do anything about this, it would be Lord Johnny. As he laid out weapons, he began to smile with more confidence. It was true what Dr. Allen said about being dizzy if he moved too suddenly, Johnny discovered as he dressed. His arm was very sore and stiff. It was a bit hard to dress. Mr. Tsung got him into the plain green uniform they all wore. He buckled the Smith & Wesson with the left-hand holster and a blast pistol with the right-hand holster around Johnny's waist. He rigged a black silk sling for his arm and then adjusted it so that Johnny could get the arm out of it fast and draw the Smith & Wesson if he had to. He made Johnny check it to make sure he could do that. Then he gave Johnny the plain green helmet.
"Now you shoot them," said Mr. Tsung.
He made his hand into a pistol and fired twice.
Bang, bang!
He was very confident now, smiling. He tucked his hands in his sleeves and bowed. If it were only that simple, Johnny thought. But he bowed and thanked the little man. Good Lord, he was dizzy. Made the room spin to lower his head. An unusually large explosion shook the ground. They were catching it. 3. As Johnny left his room, he saw that the underground passage also led past the hospital. Although his intention had been to go out to the cone where the platform was, concern about the wounded of the raiding party halted him by that door. A clatter was coming from the place. The click of bolts being cocked and the slap of slings, arms. He stepped inside the door. There were about 30 beds, and over half of them were occupied. But two Chinese, whose armbands showed they were from the armory, had a dolly with assorted weaponry, and they were passing out blast rifles, AK-47s with thermite ammunition, and handguns to the wounded Scots. A gray-haired Scot nurse came up to Johnny. She obviously did not approve of this commotion in her ward. Then she recognized Johnny and choked back whatever she was about to say, probably to tell him to get out. Johnny had been counting. There's 13 in here from the raiding party and 2 gunners. Are there any more?
2 lads with concussions are in surgery, said the nurse. Dr. McKendrick says their operations went well and they'll be fine. Are you supposed to be up, McTyler?
By now, one of the injured Scots had seen Johnny at the door and barked his name. Johnny had been about to go from bed to bed with apologies. It appeared there were 17 casualties out of the raiding party of 31. No, 18, including himself. Heavy. These men were badly bruised. Black eyes predominated. Several broken limbs. He felt that better planning could have averted this. But the other Scots had seen him, and they began to put up a yell. Sounded like,
Scotland, we here.
They were sitting up and yelling. Nothing wrong with their morale. Suddenly, Johnny realized that these lads had slaughtered the Brigantes and settled the blood feud of Scotland. They were victors. Their injuries were badges of honor. They would be heroes to the whole Scottish nation. No apologies needed here. He tried to shout into the din, and then simply saluted them and, with a smile and wave, withdrew. He could hear loudspeakers outside playing solemn religious music to prevent infra-beam surveillance. He came out of the passage from the bunkers and gazed into the bowl. The daylight was made murky from drifting smoke. The slight odor of the atmosphere armor at stage 3 mixed with charcoal's tang. The bowl seemed unusually crowded. It was 1,000 feet in diameter at the level of its floor. Before, he had thought that was a lot of space, about 750,000 square feet, he had guessed. But it did seem crowded now. The pagoda structure in the center extended well beyond the platform on all sides. All around the bowl, with the pagoda at its center, was a sort of wide paved road. When he had seen it before, it had almost been deserted. Over there, to the right, were 2 Italian-Swiss electricians rigging more wires into some bunkers. A German and a Swiss pilot were sorting out a dolly load of air masks. Near to hand, a Scot officer was giving some instructions to a Russian soldier. Way over to the left, a group of Swedish soldiers were sorting out ammunition on a dolly. There, just coming out of a passage which must lead outside, were two Sherpa hunters pushing a dolly load of African buffalo meat toward what must be a kitchen. Here and there, a Buddhist communicator was moving with a floating walk from one bunker to another. And scattered all about, along the inner bank, were Chinese families and their children and belongings. On one of the big posts which held up the pagoda roof, the Chinese had hung tribal shields representing the remaining tribes of Earth. A truly international scene. The peoples of Earth. Johnny was about to move on when a voice speaking Cyclo sounded behind him and to his right.
I am so sorry.
It was Chief Chong Wan, head of the Chinese tribe and principal architect of this place.
We had to bring in all the people from the village by the lake. The lake is so broad, the cable protection is thin in the center, and some bombs have come through above the dam. Waves from the explosion have made the village unsafe, and smoke from cooking fires does not escape through the screen.
He was bowing. Johnny nodded.
But see, continued Chong Wan, my engineers are digging air ducts through the hill under the cable.
Piles of dirt and rock on either side of the bowl showed where the Chinese were using spade drills to cut a channel to the outside air.
They will use intake fans in one and exhaust fans in the other. They will be curved so no bomb blasts come through. I am so sorry for the oversight.
I think you've done splendidly, said Johnny. You say bombs fall in the lake above the dam. Is there any dam injury? Chief Chong Wan beckoned a Chinese engineer, and they chattered for a moment in Mandarin. Then Chong Wan said to Johnny,
Not so far. But some have sent water over the top of the dam, and they have put in the flashboards to reduce the spillway. If the lake were to drop in volume, we would have no electricity.
The whole lowest floor of the pagoda was wide open on all four sides. The pagoda was really just a fancy roof. The metal transshipment platform was in plain view. The Chinese had polished it until it shone, even in the subdued light. Johnny walked under the high roof to get a better look at where they had put the all-important console. Then he smiled. Over on the other side of the platform, they had built a stand with sides in the shape of a huge, savage-looking winged beast. Angus was there at the console, and he waved.
That's something, isn't it? Said Angus.
Yes, it really was. A huge head, two wings, a curling tail, armored metal, painted gold and red.
A dragon, said Chong Wan. Once it was the emblem of Imperial China. See, it is laminated molecular armor.
Not only that, but it had a top. The console was set into the dragon's back, and a cover was made of dragon scales so the operator could work the console without anyone's observing what he was really doing. There were two stools on the raised console platform, and a side shelf for papers and a computer. And all armored. Nothing was going to hurt that console, or see what was being done with it either. Such a far cry from the materialistic Cyclo, who was without paintings or art. And what these Chinese could do.
See, said Chief Chong Wan, it is the same as those other dragons.
He pointed to a dragon that formed the roof point of the pagoda nearby. Each corner had one. And then the chief pointed to some unfinished work over by the bank.
Each bunker was supposed to have its dragon over the entrance. We have not had time to put them up.
They were much smaller dragons, made of baked clay and painted in gold and red. The console looked fine under the protective cover. Angus had a copy of the coordinate book there and was drilling himself without punching anything. He was figuring out how to convert the figures in the book to this moment of time and the console buttons.
I've got it pretty well, said Angus. It just takes quite a bit of time to do the calculations. There are 8 separate movements listed for each planet, and you have to pick where on the planet. But it is not too hard.
Johnny looked up. Another bomb had just hit somewhere.
If all that would stop, we'd be in